The Thing, and Deathlok.
Welcome to FW Team Up, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Siskoid.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
Taking you through a classic superhero team up, The Thing and Deathlok, from Marvel 2-in-1, number 27, cover dated May 1977. And Ryan, this is the team-up that essentially made you want to attack this run of the book.
A little bit, yeah, because we're still very much in the prologue phase of what kind of becomes this protracted story arc in Marvel 2-in-1, as The Thing is about to travel overseas for this multi-part continuous UK adventure that'll last, I think it's like 6 or 7 issues proper in that storyline, but the roots of how that all begins kind of start in the last issue that we began with Nick Fury and continue here with a character that I can say is one of my early favorite Marvel superheroes in Deathlok.
What does early mean?
In terms of when I basically discovered the Marvel comics and Marvel superheroes and like my experience with Marvel, which really starts like around 1990 is kind of when I discovered Marvel. And I discovered Deathlok in 92, and he fascinated me back then.
Okay, well, let's do that then. Let's preface with reasons why we like that guest character. What's so great about Deathlok? What charmed you? How were you thunderstruck by this character?
So my discovery of him was actually as it was in the 90s and kind of first discovering these things, a lot of my early discoveries of Marvel characters were not in comics. They were in tangential material or media like cartoons from, you know, the Spider-Man or X-Men animated series or something, or action figures as Toy Biz was churning out a bunch of that stuff, or even the Marvel trading cards. You know, if I, you know, couldn't afford to read every Marvel comic that was coming out on my, you know, my modest paper out salary, then I would get some of those Marvel Universe trading cards and just discover new characters, new ideas and concepts and things like that. But Deathlok had an action figure in 1992. And I think it was the third wave of then it was Toy Biz's Marvel Superheroes action figure line. And a friend of mine had been collecting those, and I had a few of them, not many. I had the Iron Man toy, which I really liked, and a Spider-Man that actually had suction cups on his hands so he could stick to windows. And that's how he was like a wall crawler. But one day I'm going, and I think it was a Walmart or Kmart, and I'm in the toy aisle, and I see this Deathlok action figure with the sort of same Marvel superheroes like card and dress and everything. And up to this point, their superhero line was Spider-Man, Captain America, the Fantastic Four, Daredevil, Silver Surfer, the big superheroes, and then a character that looks nothing like them. He's silver and red and yellow. He looks like this robotic monstrosity. Now, also in 1992, I'd probably just seen the movie Terminator 2, which I believe, my own little fun fact historically, I think that was the first R-rated movie that I saw in the movie theater. My brother took me to that, hijacked me and took me to that. And I loved it. And here was this character that kind of had, because prior to that, like, I thought of robots like the Star Wars droids or things from the Jetsons, kind of more like friendly, but like kind of a homogenized thing. And the Terminator and then Deathlok, there were these ideas of like half man, half machine, designed to be instruments of war and destruction and murder. And as a, you know, a kid, I was like, this is incredible. I want to see more of this. So yeah, I picked up that toy and played with him a lot. Did not fit in with Marvel, which I kind of like, I still kind of believe like he doesn't really work in Marvel comics except as a foil or contrast for the superheroes. So I used him for other things, but also, you know, there's that sort of primordial part of me that has always loved the Frankenstein story of, you know, the monster comes into awareness, existence, almost against his or her will, and would then immediately kind of be shunned because their body, their function, their physical form would be repulsive by normal standards. So they're kind of created to be a freak or an outsider that has no purpose and would therefore be condemned or cursed to not have a normal life, a normal existence, find love, things like that. And that makes them more monstrous almost by society shunning them or something like that. And I feel like Deathlok kind of works into that motif of a Frankenstein monster.
the human part of him looks like a zombie.
Right, which was something else that I hadn't really seen before. That was something so unique. It wasn't like Arnold Schwarzenegger's, you know, chiseled looks with half of his face and the other half looking like the skeletal robot. No, it looked like a dead, rotting corpse, but half robotic.
I don't have, like, that strong connection to the character. I remember reading him in maybe Marvel Comics Presents, and there was a prestige format miniseries, which wasn't actually this version, I think. It was the next version. But I do like it when we take like these great heroic archetypes and we put twists on them and have a chance to tell a story differently. So in this case, I think Deathlok is really interesting, cynical take on Captain America. Right, Cap was,
yeah,
like, at least retroactively, was frozen so he could show up in the contemporary era, but it's reversed with Deathlok. He's a man of today who wakes up in the future as a super soldier and sometimes pulls a Terminator and travels back to the Marvel Universe, where I do agree is like he's an ill-fitting component. Mm-hmm. But when he's in his own world, in his own, you know, Days of Future Past kind of place, there he works because he doesn't need anybody else. You know, like he's not clashing with the more traditional superheroes are more hopeful. It can be a story about despair, you know. Yeah. You know, you don't want him to destroy his terrible future in the same way that the Terminator franchise or whatever.
Right.
You want him to have a place to exist, and I think that place is in that corrupt, not post-apocalyptic, but dystopian future.
Yeah. One little addendum to what I was saying before, just for anybody listening, in case they were mistaken, like, my love for the character is very much nostalgia-based on the type of kid I was in the early 90s and what I was into. You know, if I was making a list of my top 50 Marvel characters today, I don't think Deathlok would be on it. That's just not the type of things that I'm necessarily as into today. I still love the character, but it's very much a wistfully looking back on, oh, remember how unique that seemed at the time, you know, before the 90s sort of showed us, oh, that's all there was. Yeah.
That's why you said early.
Right.
So you grew out of him.
Sort of, yeah. That makes me sound a little bit more mature than I am, but yeah.
Well, let's talk about Deathlok's publication history then. The first Deathlok, Luther Manning, appeared in Astonishing Tales number 25 in August of 1974, created by Rich Buckler. The concept? He's an American soldier from Detroit, Michigan, who, after being fatally injured, is reanimated in a dystopian future, originally given the date of 1990. Only to discover that what remains of his dead body has been turned into the experimental Deathlok cyborg. He verbally communicates with his symbiotic computer, to which he refers to as Pewter, the abbreviated Pewter, escapes from his creator's control, battles the evil corporate and military regimes that have taken over the U.S., while simultaneously struggling not to lose his humanity. He was initially announced as the new lead feature in Marvel's Worlds Unknown, under the title Cyborg, but actually ran in Astonishing Tales from number 25 to number 28, then 30 to 36. That's all between 1974 and 1976. And he would later guest star with Spider-Man in Marvel Team-Up and resolve his Astonishing Tales story in Marvel Spotlight number 33, just a month before the comic we'll cover today. After a couple of Marvel 2-in-1 appearances, we jump to 1983 for a Captain America arc where he works for the Brand Corporation and fights Cap and a clone of himself. Manning will return in the 90s, but by then, Marvel has created a new Deathlok. Right, Ryan?
Yes, and in the 90s up to today, greatly inspired by the film RoboCop, Marvel rebooted the Deathlok concept with a four-issue miniseries in 1990. A scientist named Michael Collins, betrayed by his superiors at a greedy, amoral tech company, is turned into Deathlok, but he resists his murderous programming to become a hero. The miniseries spun off into its own ongoing series that lasted 34 issues from 1991 until 1994. Throughout this time, Deathlok also made guest appearances in various Spider-Man-related books, Silver Sable and the Wild Pack, as well as War Machine. In the late 90s, a third version of Deathlok debuted, this time a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent named Jack Truman. First introduced in the pages of Cable in 1998, the new Deathlok series featured Truman kicked off in 1999 and lasted 11 issues. Throughout the aughts and the 2010s decades, each of the previous Deathlocks appeared again in sporadic issues or stories. The concept of the Deathlock technology as a cyborg soldier animating a corpse was also used for tech zombie armies in other series like Black Panther and Uncanny X-Force. During this era, a different live-action version of Deathlock was introduced in the MCU ABC television series Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. After this, a fourth version of Deathlock was created in the comics intended to be similar to the television version, but not exactly the same. Later still, the character of Jenna Simmons, originally created for the aforementioned Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. show, was brought into the comics and later turned into yet another version of Deathlock. So...
Everybody gets to be Deathlock.
Everybody gets to be Deathlock. I will say, like, in terms of modern stories with Deathlock, I actually really like the conceit of it just being an army, a sort of post-apocalyptic army of, like, these, like, half-corpse, half-soldiers that they introduce. I think visually it's kind of cool. I do like some of the earlier ones. Like, the first Deathlock comics I read were that original four-issue miniseries, I think by Dwayne McDuffie. I think he was the one who wrote the miniseries.
Yep.
But going back to the original comics, which is the Luther Manning version that you described and the one that's going to be in the comic that we're reading here, I did read those a couple of years ago, and I also got an issue of Alter Ego magazine that had an interview with Rich Buckler about the character and concept. And I think part of, because you mentioned he was originally supposed to be debuting in the World's Unknown magazine or something, and then it ended up changing. So I think Marvel, like, Roy Thomas gave Buckler the green light to, like, work on this concept, but then Marvel got into a thing where they were going to do Bionic Man comics, so they tabled Buckler's idea for Cyborg, and then it kind of came about later, or they either didn't get Bionic Man, or they only had it for, like, less than a year, and then they were like, okay, you can do your Deathlock thing. And Buckler's original name for the character was Deadlock, D-E-A-D, and then just L-O-C-K. And it was Doug Munch, the scripter, who changed it to Deathlock. And Buckler was like, I don't know why he did that, but whatever. It works. And then according to Buckler, it was Stan the Man Lee himself who came up with the descriptor Deathlock, the Demolisher. And Buckler's like, I always hated that. I thought it was dumb, but it was Stan Lee's idea, so he couldn't change it.
I agree. It is dumb.
Yeah.
I don't think it fits. What is he demolishing?
Yeah,
we know Stan Lee just loved alliteration. There was many options. Destroyer. None of them are good.
No.
You know, he's a killing machine is what he is. Like, he's a programmable assassin.
I mean, it wouldn't have been as alliterative, but imagine if he had been Deathlock the Terminator. And then you gotta change Deathstroke's thing.
You gotta change Deathstroke, and it also, like, this is much closer to Terminator as it would become in the 80s.
Yeah.
Alright, so this issue is called Day of the Demolisher. There you go. It's written by Marv Wolfman with art by Ron Wilson and Pablo Marcos. It goes a little like this. The Fixer and Mentallo have brought Deathlock from the future and take control of him to make him use their mind control gun on President Carter at his inauguration. Very topical. The Fantastic Four are on hand to stop them with the help of a very special guest star from FF Lore, as announced on the cover. An extra special guest appearance by a Marvel favorite, which is he?
I mean, he might have been a favorite of somebody at Marvel.
Certainly, because, and I mean, we're going to spoil this comic anyway, so let's say it's the Impossible Man who shows up in the end.
What? My favorite! I love Impossible Man!
And I've been reading, largely for the first time, the Lee Kirby run, which I like to call the Kirby Lee run, because it becomes more and more obvious that Kirby is really at the wheel of that one. When they introduce the Impossible Man, I'm reading the Omnibus, and the letters pages are in there.
Okay.
And it's pretty controversial as to whether people liked it or thought this was the worst issue of the series yet when they introduced the Impossible Man. So to say that the Impossible Man is a fan favorite, I don't know. I don't know if that's true. And then in an annual, they reprinted that story, Stan Lee doubling down. So certainly someone liked it.
It's such a play on the Silver Age imp idea. It's called Impossible Man. The word imp is in there. Yep. With like Mr. Mxyzptlk or the Batmite or, you know, other DC Silver Age heroes all had these all have these type of characters. So to bring it into Fantastic Four, which ostensibly was supposed to be bucking some of those Silver Age conventions and trying to pave new ground and do something new. It's like, okay, this is what you're doing? All right. It's like, yeah.
But we'll get to that moment. It plays strange.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Let's just start with that cover that does announce our Marvel favorite there, but otherwise is by Jack Kirby and Joe Sinnott. That's an unusual. I mean, I don't think we get a Jack Kirby Deathlok anywhere else, as far as I know.
Probably not. It's not my favorite Kirby. It's definitely not my favorite Deathlok. It's action-packed. There's so much going on. There's a lot of momentum. It's fine, but it is also very crowded, very busy. There's a lot of people, because we've got all of the FF on here, plus the two main villains, plus Deathlok, plus a crowd of spectators that may supposed to be including the president, although his face is obscured, so we don't get the likeness there. But there's also a ton of text. You know, you've already got the Marvel Comics group banner running across the top. Then Marvel 2-in-1 presents The Thing. That already takes up, you know, the top 25%. And then it goes even lower with the guest star with Deathlok. Thankfully, they didn't include the Demolisher on the cover. And then there's three word balloons plus the blister at the bottom announcing the guest star and everything like that. It's just, it's crowded. It's kind of hard to focus. The only thing you really focus on is like the energy blast right in the center of Thing's torso where he's being shot, but it's okay. I don't love it.
Yeah, although my favorite part is Reed Richards getting it in the armpit. No, I agree. It's way too busy. Every team-up book, there's that risk because of all the logos that go on there. So the more logos you have, and this is already four logos in a row, so your image is really just a square. And in that square, they're just like piled on much too much.
Yeah.
But I do find it like an interesting, I love it when an artist that is not known for a character gets to do that character. I kind of like also where the UPC symbol, where it's situated, it looks like the Human Torch is blasting. Yeah. Like it's like his blast isn't like hitting the dais where it's not like the platform isn't getting hit. It's much too high for that. The fireball, like it looks like it hit the UPC symbol. I love stuff like that.
Yeah, it does.
Whether real or accidental.
All right,
let's get into the issue. Day of the Demolisher. We're picking up from the last time. You know, the Thing and Nick Fury were fighting Fixer and Mentallo in the Baxter Building. They had just taken Deathlok out of time using the FF's time machine, and confrontation between Deathlok, who doesn't know what the hell's going on, with our heroes. And that's where we start.
And I like the first page. I like, we get like the title, we get this little narrow insert panel of like a close up on Deathlok's eyes, so we can see, you know, the one cybernetic eye with the big, like, kind of glowing red orb, like for like the digitalization of his eyes. And then on the other side of his face, it's this kind of gray pulpy husk with a scar over his eye and everything. And you kind of see the dead tissue and his almost bat-like nose, because, you know, he's lost like the tissue there. And then it pulls out to this larger image where right behind Deathlok as he's aiming the blaster at his enemy is the Thing and Nick Fury. And I like the composition. That's a cool first page.
And you gotta love the trope. Like, anytime somebody gets cyborged, it seems like they only half their face gets torn off.
Yes.
In whatever accident they were in, they lost half their face, exactly half their face. And every cyborg type character has like half a face. And that's how you know they're a cyborg. But yeah, it's like third person shooter, you know, where you're just behind their shoulder.
Third person limited shooter. Yeah. But we're still very much attached to this one POV. It's
just well, you know, Grand Theft Auto. Let's have one where it's Deathlok. Deathlok video game.
I would play that.
And he's like in the dystopian future and he's killing corporate guys and evil military, you know, stuff like that.
Call of Duty 1990. Dystopian 1990. It's the future, but it's also 25 years ago.
Isn't like Fallout kind of like retro?
Yes, yeah.
And so obviously at this point, they have not yet taken control of Deathlok using their mind control devices, because they're just sort of cajoling him into fighting. Like, we're your friends here. Do as we say.
That's how he phrases it. The Fixer says, don't worry, Deathlock. We're your friends. Do as we say. You know, the way you talk to your friends.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you were transported into a completely foreign situation and somebody said, the big rock monster is your enemy, I would probably take that on face value at first. Like, I would just assume. So
I don't think Mentallo and Fixer look like good guys necessarily, but on the other side of there's a monster and a pirate.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Maybe you think, and we're about to lose this element here, because there's a fun credit. Beth Bleckley for computer type was credited on this issue, and it's obviously it's Pewter's voice.
Yeah, yeah.
And I find it very hard to read.
Yeah.
And once, like on page 3, they do zap Deathlock. And I mean, at that point, he becomes under control.
Mm-hmm.
Or a certain control.
Right.
And at that point, we lose Pewter. Like, he can't hear that voice anymore in his head. And so Beth didn't get a full paycheck on this one.
Maybe for the best, considering how hard it was to read.
It's like those computer fonts, very retro today, but you recognize it as a, like, the way computers were scripted in movies and TV, you know, like that sort of font. Yeah, it's real tough to read. They escape with Deathlock at that point, you know, throwing some illusions as they go.
Ah, the illusions.
The illusions, yeah. It's, I don't know if whose fear this is, because it's like, I'm going to recreate your deepest fears by probing your unconscious. And there's like this really crappy looking dinosaur. That's a terrible looking dinosaur.
It is. It also, and I will come back to this later, that should not be the deepest fear of either of these gentlemen.
Right. Where does that come from? I also kind of stumbled at that point. Like, what?
See, Ben actually says, shine my shoes. It's a blamed dinosaur. That's an interesting expression. That's his expletive, shine my shoes. And Nick is, Ben, it's not real. Quickly, cover your eyes. It's just, it's a dinosaur. Look at the things you fought.
And wasn't that something similar in the previous issue where we saw S.H.I.E.L.D. agents being menaced by a monster? It's like everybody's afraid of monsters.
Right.
Doesn't seem relatable. And if at least Ron Wilson thought, oh, you know, I'm really good at drawing dinosaurs. He's not. It's a very gooey, like a melted plastic dinosaur is what this looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't get whether Marv asked for this and Wilson couldn't really do it well, or if, you know, Marvel Method, that's his idea and it's not a good one.
They couldn't fit Galactus into that room of the Baxter building, because that should have been
right. The
thing that freaked Ben out.
If you're going to do like a specific character, like you make Dr. Doom show up.
Right.
And they shouldn't have the same fear.
Right. Maybe they had one wild adventure during World War II that they've agreed never to talk about. And it's like this
Dinosaur Island.
Yeah, wrong comic book publisher, but yeah, basically that same idea.
Yeah.
The war that these guys had their own little war that Time Forgot spinoff.
We then move to the villain's headquarters and a recap of like who's Deathlock, how they got to. I mean, they did well in showing that they would know about Deathlock. If not, I don't know how you make the machine grab a specific person based on this information or anything, but that's like the technobabble element. But to remember that, yeah, Spider-Man fought him once, and it wasn't in contemporary New York, so good thing Mentallo can read minds.
Right. Yeah, this is one of those things that I had a creative writing teacher who always told me one of the biggest sins you can commit is having a flashback inside a flashback. And this one isn't quite that, but having Mentallo flashback to when he saw Spider-Man and then through that probe the mind to kind of get Deathlock's backstory and origin into that. I was like, okay, there's a little bit much, but
I mean, we need these pieces on the board.
I guess we do.
That's how we get there. I agree. It's also, we're getting at this point what I call a pissing contest between the two villains. So, no, I'm the genius, you know, kind of.
Which low-key is
the one with
the
most exposition.
That's actually one of the best parts of the script. This is exactly how the villains would act. Like, this makes sense. This is better than them coming up with weird powers and things. It's just like, yeah, of course they're going to fight over who's more responsible, who's taking credit.
It was my plan.
Yeah,
but only Mentallo could have supplied the information. Yeah, you're partners, but...
But that's why they're villains.
That's how it works. That's how it works. You're a team, guys. Then chapter two, War in Washington. You know, we're January 20th, 1977. It is the actual, well, not the actual, the comic book version of the inauguration for Jimmy Carter, which would have happened in the real world. I checked Mike's Amazing World of Comics, and this came out, was on the stands, 1st of February of that year. So...
Yeah, so-
That's real close.
Right.
And so I don't expect, you know, obviously there's going to be some superhero elements and then not an assassination attempt, but a mind control attempt on the president. So it's not going to be the same. But, you know, as we'll see, the details of the inauguration, even the ones you could have predicted, are not at all what should have happened.
Well, given how much time, they really only, I mean, they could have had the election gone a different way. They could have rewritten the script to just change one name, and they only had to draw the face one or two times.
Well, the election would have been in November, so...
Yeah, they had 3 months.
That time.
Yeah.
Or they might have guessed at that point. I don't know how close that election was or wasn't. Not before my time in terms of life, but before my time in terms of political awareness. And this is the page where, it's page 10 there, but really it's the sixth page. This is where there's what I call a case of revertigo. I think The Thing, and not just on this page, but from then on, feels much more like The Thing of the Fantastic Four rather than The Thing who is the star of his own book. He's a little dumber. He has more of a temper.
Yeah.
In a way that's normal and relatable, because when you get back into your family... You know, when you see your family after a year or something, or old friends, you sort of fall into patterns.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, the way you behave around your family or around your friends is different than the way you behave at work or the way you behave in other social settings. I mean, we all have many faces that we wear. So this kind of makes sense that once the others show up, he stops acting like Marvel 2-in-1 Ben and starts reverting to Fantastic Four Ben. I think that's a good... Yeah, that works.
And since I've been rereading these early Fantastic Four comics, it's like he's going to mention Yancey Street. He's going, oh my God, it's like Marv Wolfman just read a bunch of Lee Kirby issues and boom. It did feel like suddenly the thing that I came to know in the team-up series, okay, no, that's no longer true. You know, he becomes the thing of the Fantastic Four, and he really does take a sort of backseat throughout this issue in terms of, like, he gets a share of action, but it does feel like it's more of a Fantastic Four story.
Yeah, I agree.
They're going to that inauguration.
Right.
They've been invited, and they're the only superheroes invited, which may or may not be a security measure.
After Johnny, in typical Johnny fashion, gets kind of tired of hanging out with the family and wants to take off, he flames on, he jumps out the window of the hotel and just starts flying around Washington. And he is spotted by Mentallo looking out through their window, and he sees him. And there's just one line here. He goes, it's the one called the Torch. It's like, you know who he is. But he says, he's moving too quickly for me to get a reading on him. Moving too quickly. Okay. For some reason, that triggered in my memory, and Chris Franklin will love this, the old commercial for the Mego's World Greatest Superheroes toy line. Because for the Mego Fantastic Four figures, they described the Torch as faster than the speed of light, or something like that. Like, that was one of his powers. Like, that's not the thing he's known for. But, like, maybe since they were advertising to kids, like toys for kids, they couldn't talk about how he's a guy on fire. Do this at home, kids. Because they would get sued for that. So I just like that they call him faster than the speed of light. That's the same commercial where they refer to as Mr. Fantastic and the Invisible Woman, both gifted with the power of invisibility. No, that's not true. And the same commercial that refers to Green Arrow as crime fighter from the forest, and the Falcon as that great black superhero.
Just, oh, like, God.
Such a commercial. The first time I saw that, I was like, wow, this these descriptors. So
Yeah, the madmen in charge didn't really know their
comics.
Not sure
who gave them the copy for these characters, but whatever.
Now, Deathlok gets his mission. Like, he's under control, but not, right? It's like, it almost feels like the Thing earlier, when he was under control in the previous issue, he was just a blank. Like, he didn't know what he was doing. He was just acting on orders. You know, he wasn't, like, thinking, damn it, I'm under control. But perhaps because Deathlok has two brains, a computer brain and a human brain, maybe he can, like, parse it out because he's compelled to do the missions, which normally would have been the computer compelling him. But he can also comment on it. Like, he's almost going to be acting like a genie.
Right.
Trying to find the loopholes in the orders.
And this is probably my favorite part of the whole story, is Deathlok's internal monologue and internal dilemma here, and this whole sort of existential crisis of being controlled and given this singular purpose of murdering an innocent person that you don't want to do but can't stop. And it's like, where he even, I mean, for a book in 1977, he's talking about suicide. He says, I would rather blow my own brains out, but I can't. And this whole dilemma, this crisis that he's feeling, I liked the way this was scripted. I liked the way this was delivered. It gave some real pathos to this character who, unfortunately, doesn't get a real denouement or a real epiphany at the end of this story. We'll get to that in a few pages. But I liked this whole scene when he's out on his own and he's going through this internal struggle of having, it's the struggle of not having free will. The struggle is, you know, like being destined and compelled to do something like this that you want to avoid at all costs, but just are unable and feeling like a puppet.
And like the Thing, who is also like a Marvel character in that mold where I've been cursed with these powers. I've been cursed with this life. And this is like the more hardcore version of that. You know, it's not just like a physical ugliness and, you know, lack of choices. It really is. There's a thing in my head that's preventing me from doing what I want to do. And what I want to do is end it. It's really hardcore. And we're going to get a lot of scenes, panels of Deathlok aiming at the White House and, you know, it's like at people in crosshairs. So this is, you know, this is a pretty potent stuff for a 1970s comic.
Okay. Because I'm looking at the digital version, so the pages might not be there. It's the story page right before chapter 3. So it's the page with Deathlok on the rooftop going through this whole thing. That last panel where he says, right, Pewter? And he's like talking like Pewter doesn't respond. He's like, yeah, right. That last panel. The cityscape in the background. I guess it's supposed to be the Capitol building, although what we see that it looks very narrow, but there's also like another steepled building behind it. For some reason, I looked up at that. I was like, is that the Kremlin? Where is he? What city is he in? Because, like, in my version, at least, there's a red sun behind it, so it's kind of creating this, like, red Russia feel. I'm like, where is he? What is going on?
If we're talking about some of the details of this inauguration, there's a setting sun, right? That's a setting sun, it's not the sunrise. So it's a setting sun, so this inauguration is going to take place in the evening at night. It's also going to be taking place in the White House backyard.
Yes, this is not on the steps of the Capitol.
No, so, and it's on like a sort of bandstand, sort of a dais podium with big flags all around. This is not what any inauguration has ever looked like.
No.
And I've looked at pictures, obviously, and I was like, oh, did they like accidentally get it right? Or, you know, had they seen it, they might have dressed Jimmy Carter differently. Just the suit, like he's got a flower on his boutonniere, and then, you know, that's... That wasn't the case at the time. It's more like a big coat. It's January, you know?
No, well, I'm sure this was mostly illustrated before the inauguration. I mean, if this was published a week after, then yeah, they had to be just drawing. So they're basing this on either pictures of previous inaugurations or just like the idea. It's like
not even that because it's not on the Capitol steps.
Right, yeah.
And hopefully there's no building where a sniper, like a building that just across the street where the sniper can sit. And wait, there's no Secret Service, there's no military presence, there's never a question. This is all happening even before Reed Richards is going to make that call to a special guest star to help. They don't expect trouble, you know, or if they do, oh, I guess the Fantastic Four are around. That's good enough. Yeah. You know, doesn't quite work in terms of story logic or according to the real world anyways.
When they say Marvel, your universe... Is it?
Well, it's got the same president. Yeah. It just happened differently. Yeah. And if you're a kid and, you know, you didn't watch that inauguration.
Yeah.
This might have been, yeah, that's how it happened. So, you know, in chapter 3, battle with the bionic berserker. Well, there's some alliteration.
Yeah.
That's almost better. Like, Nick Fury tells him, yeah, this could be dodgy. We got Deathlok out there. We haven't found him yet. He's on a rooftop next to the building. We haven't found him yet. Reed Richards says, well, no, okay, I got to do this. I got to call someone I didn't want to call. It's risky. You got to give someone the most dangerous task he's ever performed. I have no choice, not if the safety of the president is at stake. And he's like, I need help. He's, you know, he's stuttering through this call. And we don't know who he's calling. The die is cast. There can be no turning back. Right. And it's going to be the impossible man.
Exactly. Like, I have to think, like, they're setting this up so that you think maybe it's Dr. Doom or something. Like, who else would Reed be that reluctant to call in for help? Assuming he couldn't just call in the Avengers or other superheroes, somebody who might have a stake in this, but, like...
It's really a weird, why is he so shook? It's kind of ridiculous that the Impossible Man is going to replace Jimmy Carter. Mm-hmm. Sure, you know, and we're going to paint him colors because normally that Jimmy Carter would be green and purple. Right. So, you know, we have to like put some makeup on, which is going to dissolve at the right moment. And we go through all of this. Now, who else is in the Fantastic Four that you don't need to call? The Invisible Girl. Who has force field powers.
I was going to come to that. This was the thing. Like, yeah.
I mean, you had it right there.
It's like, she's got force field powers if we need to protect somebody from being shot by a sniper. Or, in a chaotic situation when there's attack, she can not only make herself invisible, she can make other people and things invisible. She is the right. best person to have for a presidential protection detail. Like, literally, she's the best one to have by your side. Like, think about your wife, Reed. Not just like that. In like a tactical context. This is what you need. This is perfect. And they completely flubbed this. Like, this was the thing where I was like, when I read this, I was like, wait a minute, when did she get the force field powers? Like, no, that was back in like Fantastic Four, like 60 or something. Like, in there, like that was.
Oh, no, even yeah. earlier. It happens like in the second year.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
I was surprised at how early it came up. And it came up because of a controversy. People were, there was like a letter writers, not a lot, because they said a minority of people were saying that Invisible Girl should be out of the team. That you should get like a better member because she's useless. And then suddenly, boom, she's got these powers that just like suddenly. Yeah. And it's in response to those letter writers. Right. I mean, it seems pretty clear. but this, again, this is like a Revertigo element where the Fantastic Four are kind of acting like in the first years of their series. Mm-hmm. Sue is useless. Reed comes up with this plan, doesn't tell anyone. The Lee Kirby series was full of all that. Right. Reed Richards never explained his plan, and at the end, he would say, haha, like, do the Silver Age thing where you explain everything. And even his teammates are like, you couldn't say anything? You couldn't tell us about this? You know, it's like he never explains himself. And this is sort of what happens here as well. You know, it's like they all think, oh, no, mm-hmm. you know, the president's been shot. Why let them believe this? Well, I couldn't, you know, I can't trust I don't know, that somebody else would get taken over. I don't know what he doesn't trust, but...
Maybe Reed was secretly hoping this was his indirect way of killing off the Impossible Man so they wouldn't have to deal with it again.
If that's the plan, he doesn't say it either, right? And let's never say anything. There's another scene at this point where the Fixer and Mentallo make sure that they check in with Deathlok that he did scout the location, that he's ready to go and do it. He's a little bit, after I'm done with this, I'm off the clock and I'm coming for you.
Which is what you always want to do to the bad guy, is announce your intention to double-cross them.
They should have given him orders right then and there, not to do that. If he's taking orders, right. And it's got to be to the letter. And we finally see Jimmy Carter, who is the Impossible Man, but we don't know that. Ben is on the stage. Nick Fury, super spy, is on the stage. And I'm thinking, like, at this point, it's like, if only they'd come up with the plan earlier. If they'd come up with the Impossible Man plan earlier to lure Deathlok to this location, the real inauguration's on the Capitol steps. You know, you sort of mystify the villain.
Right, a decoy, yeah.
That would make more sense than what we see here. But talking about, like, loopholes in the orders, this is where Deathlok decides, They didn't tell me to hide. They didn't tell me to snipe this guy. Just to shoot him with the mind control device. So his plan is to just like barge through the police barricades and shoot him almost point blank. They don't necessarily say it here, but I think he's more like, I'm doing a suicide run.
He's basically trying suicide by cop. He's hoping that they will stop him before he shoots the president, and the heroes ostensibly are trying to protect the president, and they both fail spectacularly.
Yeah, but also, I mean, what they don't say, which is actually the brilliance of the plan, is or accidental brilliance, is that by doing it this way, everyone will know that he's been shot with the mind control device.
Yeah.
The plan, which was that the president would be under control and Fixer and Mentallo would use him to do things, he would have been checked, even if he'd started like spouting orders.
Right. They would have done a full body scan, a full medical checkup and everything like that. They would have discovered, oh yeah, you've got this chip on you that's stuck there.
Yeah.
Making you take orders from a villain in a green costume.
Right. And they've been like pretty big.
Even though after he shot, I don't know if they ever mention that again. Like, I don't know if Sue knows that that's what he shot with her, or if she just thinks he took a bullet.
It doesn't work on the Impossible Man. We don't see him removing it or anything. We'll see later. He's like holding his arm like he got shot for real, and he's not under control. Or it doesn't matter, because in any case, in the White House backyard, there's a big fight. Here's the things moment. There's a big fight between him and Deathlok, where they just punch at each other, basically, and throw themselves at the flags. And
lots of destruction.
Sue is beside herself. Oh, you know, Ben was supposed to stop that Deathlok before we could fire. If anything happens to him, if he's been killed, the Fantastic Four is responsible. Like, Reed Richards, please, like, confide in your own wife, who might have then said, oh, I can just throw up a force field.
Exactly.
And we got like the Human Torch and Reed Richards, meanwhile, going after Mentallo and the Fixer. They're apparently safe from Mentallo's illusory dinosaurs because the Human Torch has a heat shield.
There you go.
It's so hot in here, you can't use your powers. That's also very Revertigo, because I felt like the early issues, Human Torch could do anything.
The power of fire can do whatever it wants.
Whatever you want. You know, but they're throwing a little fire ring around the Fixer's tools, and the heat shield protects against Mentallo. So these guys are, I don't know what that gun is that Fixer has, which has like a hacksaw in the front of it.
I don't know if like that's how the control chip is supposed to stick into Reed, maybe? Like that's supposed to like pierce his kind of rubbery skin. I don't know what it's a nasty looking projectile that Fixer shoots at him. And then it's instantly just, like, melted by Johnny's flame. So I liked that action beat. That was one of the better moments I liked.
And meanwhile, you got, like, the thing is, that fight goes on and on and on. And finally, Ben realizes, hey, maybe this guy's under control.
As he's still whomping him, he's like, maybe it's not entirely his fault. Punch. Maybe I should stop this, or at least go easier on him. Punch.
I mean, he was under control last issue.
Maybe he should be a little bit more receptive to this idea.
Sue finally remembers that she's got powers. There's too many innocent people. That means this fight must end now. You got Revertigo'd thing going, oh, just let me one more, you know. She's always whining about not punching people enough in the original series. And yeah, so you could have thrown up the force field can contain Deathlok, no problem. She could have thrown that up around him, around the president at any time. Anytime.
And then Reed and Johnny walk into the scene with the Fixer and Mentallo captured. And at this point, doesn't it seem like all the other members of the Fantastic Four accomplished more than the titular heroes of this story?
The cover only promises Thing versus Deathlok, which we did get.
Yeah.
But yeah, it seems like the Fantastic Four did their thing, you know, and kind of almost used the Thing as just like a delaying tactic. Like, you take care of this, which apparently Sue Storm could have stopped at any time. And the other two. And then you got the Impossible Man as the special guest star who makes sure that Carter isn't killed, or not killed, but I mean, that's the iconography,
right,
is that he's going to get shot, but, you know, mind controlled. I'm even a little bit disappointed that in the Thing elements, like, you go through all the stuff where the Thing is in a tux and you don't have him fight in a tux and like rip the tux to shreds during the fight. Like, he takes it off before He's even on the dais, like, even during the speech, he's already in chest.
Yeah, they completely forgot about that.
He's already not wearing it. Like, as soon as they knew that there could be trouble, he took off the tux, which he hated to wear anyways, but could have been, like, a more fun visual. Oh, well. Obviously, the inauguration goes forward as planned with the real president. I think the Impossible Man almost became president of the United States.
Yeah, he could have been, yeah.
I'm not sure how that works, but
Well, we don't know if the Chief Justice was there to swear him in. If he had put his hand on it, then never know. Maybe he would have been. It's a wacky issue. It's a crazy story that I kind of love for its ridiculousness. It is fun. It does not make the heroes look very good. Like, we get this crazy presidential cameo, sort of. I also just remembered that, like, not only do we get Carter mentioned and illustrated in a few of these pages, but they name drop his daughter, Amy, and his mom, Lillian. They're both mentioned when the Fantastic Four first go to Washington. It's like, okay, they were thinking about the whole family in this one. But yeah, so there's some craziness. This isn't things best showing. It is a product of its time where if you think about that, it's like, boy, if you had just included the woman in your plans, all of this could have been avoided. But I like at the crux of this issue is Deathlok's, like, moral, you know, existential crisis of being struggling to get his own free will, struggling to be able to resist his programming and not quite being able to, and then trying to find the loophole. I think, like I mentioned, like, even willing to commit suicide by cop just to avoid this horrible thing, and then it doesn't work because our main hero is incompetent in this case. And then, yeah, unfortunately, it's kind of abbreviated, and we don't get that closure for Deathlok in this one, because once they're captured, he just becomes, like, he's almost, like, catatonic.
At this point, his story is over. His solo story arc is over, and he's, like, sort of dropping in other books, you know, teaming up with Marvel stars, which isn't really his world. They're struggling to find something for him to do, or if that's necessary at all. All right, who fared better? How well does this fit each of their stories' atmospheres? Is this a Thing story or more of a Deathlok story? Because definitely Deathlok's mission, you know, with the Fixer standing in for Stryker as the controller. Yeah. But there's all this FF stuff.
Yeah, and the FF almost kind of hijacks the story from Ben himself, and they are more critical to, like, the third act and the resolution of everything like that while he's just doing his punching bit. But he doesn't even... I don't want to tip my hand, but I struggled to even give him a really good hero moment. So I think almost by the neglect of Ben, I think this is more of a Deathlok story. And also, as what I just said a couple of seconds ago, my favorite part was just, like, Deathlok's inner crisis when he's on that rooftop, just thinking about what he's doing and trying to fight back, but he can't.
Yeah, I think I'll agree with you on that one. Cool moves. What is the Thing's coolest move?
Punching, I guess. Just like, that's all I could come up with. Like, I don't know if there's one that was really more impressive than the other. I mean, he does kind of do his... I don't know if it was like his trademark signature move, but I think he did it a lot. He pulls up the floor at one point and just throws a piece of the floor. That was okay, but yeah. It was just random punching the robot. Yeah.
It's not great. Like, at least he realizes that Deathlok is on their side, belatedly...
Doesn't really stop fighting him, but...
No, you're right. So, yeah, not a great issue for Ben Grimm. What about Deathlok's coolest move?
I actually like his sort of epiphany is like, hey, I can still sort of accomplish my mission. I can still follow their instructions, but make myself such an obvious threat that they'll stop me before I actually get tar. So when he actually breaks through the police barricade and sawhorses and marches in full view of the president's protection detail, that should have worked. That was a good way of like beating the program. But like I said, the people were incompetent.
A big Secret Service fail. And, like, they're just... they look like guests. They might well be guests. I don't know. There's, like, guys in dark suits back there just looking stunned. That's not great. Also, it's not really the president on the podium, and I don't know if they know that. But, yeah, running right at the podium, I think that's the coolest move here. He's quoting Spock in Star Trek VI. I've been dead before, you know. So, yeah, I'm not only am I giving this to him, but I'm saying Deathlok is cooler than the Thing.
Yeah, definitely.
What about weird moves or dumb moves?
Ben gets scared by a dinosaur that doesn't even look like a real dinosaur. It looks like a kid's drawing of a dinosaur.
And I would also say, though, he's tough as a tank, stiff collars still hurt his neck. You know, it's like, I feel choked in this.
Did he call it a monkey suit? I'm surprised he didn't call it a monkey suit.
What about Deathlok's weirdest move?
Again, like, it sounded cool at the time, but it's one of those things where it's like, if you're planning to turn on your superiors, and if you're saying, like, once I get this mission done, I'm coming back to kill you guys. Like, don't tell them that. These are not honorable people. They're going to take precautions to secure you from doing that.
Will they, though? For me, it's page 30 in the original comic where the thing lifts. I mean, the way it's presented is like the thing is lifting the dais. I'm not sure why. And Deathlok jumps on top of it.
But Deathlok was already standing on it when the thing lifted it up. I don't know. Who knows?
That's not how it's choreographed, right? So I don't know what's happening there, what's going on in that sequence. And even like the thing throws it and he doesn't seem to follow the dais into the air. That whole sequence is kind of muddled for me, and I'm going to call it the weirdest or dumbest. What about the unfriendly farewell, which is Ben's team-up tradition? Just a sneer from Deathlok. So much contempt. And Nick Fury finally says goodbye, does he? Or rather, he turns his back and hurries off to SHIELD HQ with the villains in tow. And Ben doesn't say goodbye to the Fantastic Four because that's his team. It does end on a note where he's embarrassed. You know, Reed called the imp to save their collective bacon. And he's quickly told to shut up. I wouldn't worry about it, Ben. Shut up. But, you know, everything worked out.
Yeah, this is an atypical end because it's sort of like, instead of getting, you know, the typical like Marvel team up conclusion, the unfriendly farewell as you describe it, it's like they're about to do that and Reed's like, shut up, I want to watch this, and turns on the TV. He's like, I can't hear the TV, so that he can watch the inauguration. Because yeah, we don't get a farewell, we don't get a closure. We will actually see the family, Deathlok, and Nick Fury again in the beginning of the next issue. It's like their story isn't really over yet. So, yeah, it's just kind of like time out or press pause. We'll come back to the ending later on.
A lot more serialization in these issues than we might be used to. Okay, we'll take a break for a couple of promos. We'll be back with our special features.
Cheerscast, the podcast where everybody knows your name. Slide up to the bar alongside Ryan Daly and a rotating cast of guest hosts as they celebrate the long-running, award-winning television series, one hilarious episode at a time. New episodes of Cheerscast drop every Thursday, part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
Coming soon from Amalgam Comics. Rebuilt by the Tomorrow Project to serve as a super-powered assassin armed with powerful turbines, Luther Smith's mind is split between his own and an android computer grafted into his brain. He wants to kill. He needs to kill. But his computer half thinks it's all so depressing. Codenamed the Red Death, Luther becomes the most indecisive killer for hire around. Will anything actually happen in this series? It remains to be seen, as issue 6 of The Red Death hits the stands this week, wherever Amalgam Comics are sold.
We're back, our monthly feature, the bonus team-up, in which each of us proposes, in this case, a perfect Deathlok team-up. What do you have?
I like kind of thinking of something outside, something where the characters aren't necessarily in their normal element, and thinking about how Deathlok doesn't really work with the superhero element. I kind of kept playing that off and how Deathlok reminds me of the Terminator, and he also reminds me of RoboCop and what other 1980s sci-fi action franchises there were. And I started thinking about Deathlok versus the Predator. And I thought that would be kind of cool, but I was like, well, what about the team up? Well, if they had to team up, what would they team up against? Well, obviously aliens. So some kind of crazy story, and I don't have the details. I think you can just imagine the details for themselves. But initially, Deathlok and the Predator are at odds and end up having to work together, or at least find a common purpose in fighting off hordes of the xenomorphs from the Aliens franchise. So,
are we sure that Dark Horse has never published such a series.
I would imagine they did probably do Terminator and Predator and Aliens or RoboCop or something like that. That sounds like something I would have seen on the shelf but didn't read in 1990, but yeah.
I've been called out in the past for, doing something, like not doing a DC Marvel, keeping it to the Marvel universe. So this time I will go Marvel DC and do a Deathlok and Cyborg, since that might have been his original name, or at least the name of the strip. I do wonder if Marv Wolfman remembered even writing the character when he created Vic Stone. I may be a connection there. So Monarch would act as villain, once again torturing his old Titan friends by sending them through alternate timelines and futures. And since it's a Marvel DC crossover, let's put Kang in there to help him. It's a whole event. It's not just an issue. It's a whole event with other Titans matched to other Marvel characters. Nightwing and Spider-Man 2099. For example, Changeling and Old Man Logan. Deathlok and Cyborg, of course, they're forced to fight until their computer brains interface and they team up against the enemy. I'm not overthinking it, but I did kind of create an event around this. So I did overthink it.
Because then after Cyborg is created, then Dwayne McDuffie was writing a Deathlok book or something like that. And that Deathlok, the second Deathlok, was an African-American man who was turned into the machine. And they had that very much that half cybernetic faceplate and everything like that. I just wonder if the second Deathlok was partly inspired by Cyborg. That was inspired by the first Deathlok.
It goes round and round.
I wanna rock!
As usual, we're riffing on Ryan's deep interest in music to bring you his musical selection to go with the comic and its guest star. Ryan, what are we listening to while we read this comic?
All right, so my first thought, based on the inauguration subplot of this, was Hail to the Chief, but I thought we can probably do better, something better than that. Now, bear with me, because this is kind of an oddball choice for this issue. And keep in mind that I do like to go with some kind of period-appropriate music for these team-ups. I want to pick a song that would have been somewhat contemporary for the time, or at least debuted before the comic was published in 1977. So it couldn't be a modern song or an 80s or 90s rock song or something like that. And the song I went with was Save the Life of the Child by Simon and Garfunkel from the 1968 album Bookends. Simon and Garfunkel, I mean, it is a duo, so it kind of has the team-up or two-in-one flair for it. They were obviously really well-known as an acoustic folk guitar group with great harmonic vocals. This particular song, though, sounds a little bit different than a lot of their work because it has this synthesizer that kicks off the beginning of the song and is predominant throughout the song. So it has a very different, almost discordant kind of sound from what you might be useful if you're really just familiar with Simon and Garfunkel from their greatest hits. And that synth sound kind of gives me like a feeling of like the futuristic and feels like a kind of a Deathlok vibe. Now, the song also is unique in that it has, so it's a kind of a studio technique called xenochrony, wherein a piece of music established, and it might be just like a drum fill or a guitar solo or some other, like a bass line or something, but a piece of music that was recorded elsewhere for something else is then taken in isolation and inserted into a new song, giving it a new and different context. So the song Save the Life of the Child uses xenochrony by dropping in the vocal, the chorus from the song The Sounds of Silence, when they say, "Hello, darkness, my old friend." But it's a kind of like a slowed down, dreamy echo effect in the middle of this song. So, what does that mean? It's an example of something being pulled out of time and dropped into a different song or setting, which feels like it's kind of, that's fitting for a Deathlok story in this case, where he's pulled into the present time. And then this song also, yeah, it came out, you know, two elections prior to this comic, but Simon and Garfunkel, their songs were known for kind of commenting on the social, political changing times. And here we have a comic featuring the inauguration of a new president from a new party and the changing times that were going to come with that. So all of that is why I picked this oddball selection of Save the Life of My Child, sorry, from Simon and Garfunkel.
That's a pretty clever. I mean, the way you worked it out and listening to the song, it does have that, I don't know, dystopian Terminator music to it, even though it's recognizably them. But because there's actually a song, I mean, Wikipedia told me this because it's really not my bag, but there's actually a song about Deathlok. Psychotron by Megadeth was apparently inspired by this character.
Really?
Yeah. Obviously, it wouldn't fit your criteria. The song did not exist.
Still.
But yeah, apparently, you know, so this is a character that it seems obscure, you know, in terms of the Marvel Universe at large, but was well-remembered by others.
I think Cartoon Network also had a show called Metalocalypse, featuring this this heavy metal rock band called Death Clock, which I watched that show a lot, and it was hilarious, actually, and the metal songs they played were insane. Songs that could actually make, like, hordes of people in the audience die just by hearing the songs, and it was funny.
May or may not be an inspiration. Okay, now it's time for feedback on our previous episode together, in which we covered Marvel 2-in-1 number 26, starring The Thing and Nick Fury. Let me start here with Bucky749. He offers his usual team-up ideas and has Nick Fury tagging some pro wrestlers turned G.I. Joe members, and alternatively, Savage Dragon.
That would have been interesting. I can see that. Travis Morgan said, "Love this podcast and the many others you produce. Your concern about Nick Fury smoking in the helicarrier is unfounded." Hey, as an older comics fan, I remember the golden days of air travel when there was no security or x-rays or safety measures or anything like that. Now that's my God. Travis says, "And you could meet your family right at the gate as they got off the plane. The other thing you could do is smoke on the plane. Have you ever noticed the ashtrays built into the armrests? That's why the no smoking light is right next to the seatbelt light. So you could smoke in a sealed, pressurized environment. Before they totally banned smoking on airplanes, they did have a smoking and non-smoking section, which is absolutely laughable." Yeah, all of that is a good point. And I realized afterwards, I was like, yeah, like a smoking aboard the helicarrier is not the same thing as smoking in a all atmosphere environment, like in a spaceship or something like that. Like if you were actually in a rocket or something like that, it is a completely different thing. It doesn't make it right, but yeah, I get your point. And I do have, yeah, while the youngest member of the Fire and Water Network, I am old enough to remember that, yeah, you could smoke on planes and all these things. You could actually go right up to the gate and watch your family depart or arrive. So fun times.
To be fair, the helicarrier probably has more explosive substances than most planes.
Good point.
And Sheer says, "Fun episode, especially the let's go down, walk a wild, and go up to the helicarrier bit. I haven't collected much Fury in my days, but I did get that 90s Chaikin miniseries, which was way too 90s. It felt like Chaikin was mailing it in and not his usual fare." I haven't seen that. I haven't read that.
Rob McCarthy left us a comment, and so his idea for a team up with Nick Fury: years before the Fantastic Four, Nick Fury goes to his shrink telling him about aliens. That psychiatrist happens to be Dr. Druid, and then they stop the bad guys, and Fury's report ends up getting Reed Richards his funding. And then he says in all caps, "Justice for Dr. Druid." Possibly my least favorite Avenger, but at least somebody has an idea for a Dr. Druid story.
Tim Price says, "Since you mentioned the ultimate Nick Fury, I recall his continuity being even weirder. There was an appearance by Fury in Ultimate Marvel Team-Up, I think number 14, featuring Black Widow, and he looked like classic Fury, not the Ultimates version. As far as I know, this was never explained. But that Team-Up series was supposed to be Bendis having fun expanding the Ultimate Universe, introducing some characters. Then another creator would come along and have a completely different take on that character. See Ultimate Fantastic Four as an example, and indeed, we covered that on this show. It just goes to show that even if you try to start fresh as a jumping on point for new readers, continuity problems can still happen. And as for his own team-up idea, Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos team up with the Blackhawks. So let's go retro on that one. Makes sense. Good work.
The more cynical part of me thinks Bendis came up with the ultimate Marvel team-up just so that he could have, like, his claws on all of the ultimate versions of every character. Just that he could, like, kind of, like, spread his influence as far-reaching in the newly formed Ultimate Universe as possible. And then, yeah, immediately, like, this whole new universe that was supposed to be free of all of these continuity problems, by year two, had continuity problems.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Our fellow Fire and Water Network all-star Chris Franklin said, "I was trying to think where I first encountered Nick Fury, and I think maybe a Marvel team-up or possibly a Captain America. Seems like I saw more of Dum-Dum Dugan relaying some kind of message from Fury than the man himself back then. Either way, he was in the Demetrius Zek run on Captain America quite a bit, so by then I was well acquainted with him. Like Tim said above, I never really thought about both Ben and Fury essentially being Jack Kirby. Oh, I've thought of Ben and Kirby. I've thought of Ben as Kirby, but not Fury. Kirby actually saw combat in World War II, so maybe that correlation is even more apt. Ben is the version of the Kirby who grew up on Yancey Street in Brooklyn. Fury is the Kirby who hardened on the battlefield. And like the King, they loved their cigars."
There you go. Chris Pine, who just made his Fire and Water Podcast Network debut last week, says, "We're in that era of comics where every character is ripped. Dum-Dum is in his 50s and has more muscle definition than a Hemsworth. It's not a knock. I'm a fan of Ron Wilson, and he is pretty much the official thing artist. I always read Fury like he was a version of Columbo." That's an interesting take. "He had this gruff, street tough, unrefined way of talking, this weird 1950s slang that comes across as uneducated, but underneath all of that, he was kind of playing chess and always a few steps ahead of people that underestimated him as just some grunt. But he also would shoot at his own troops to motivate them, so sometimes he wasn't playing chess, he was just a psychopath."
I think maybe more than Columbo, the Columbo actor Peter Falk, in the comedy Murder by Death, when he was playing a pastiche of Sam Spade, that type of detective. I can see that a little bit more, Nick Fury. And we got one from Scott Arthur, who said, "I was wondering if someone else would chime in with this, but it's been 2 months, so..." Okay, so that tells you a little bit about when he left this comment. Here goes. "If you aren't a Bronze Age obsessive, you might want to track down the last year of Marvel Spotlight Volume 1 to make sense of the choice of characters in this extra-long arc. The last three issues, especially, which feature Nick Fury, Spider-Woman, and Deathlok. It's important to remember that Marv Wolfman was primarily a horror writer until just a few years before this story. Yeah, he and Len Wein famously got their start working on Teen Titans in the 60s because they were nearly the same age as the characters. But until the mid-1970s, most of Wolfman's superhero stories were fill-ins, and even then, they often had a supernatural angle, like the house that haunted Batman, for example. That might be why he was editing the black and white magazines when he moved to Marvel in the early 70s. So many of them were horror-oriented. When most of that line was canceled in 1975, he was suddenly editing tons of color comics, many of them taken over from Wein. These included Marvel Spotlight and Marvel Premiere. The first thing he did was bring them back to their original purpose as showcase-style tryout books so that each feature only lasted one or two issues. That enabled him to continue interrupted horror storylines from the black and white magazines and comics. It also provided him and Archie Goodwin with unaffiliated characters to populate the increasing number of team and team-up books of the mid-70s. Ever wonder how Moon Knight wound up in the Defenders arc, or how Hercules teamed with Ghost Rider in Champions? Follow the changes in edit credits."
And we get some of that here. You know, like Deathlok is continuing on from, like, he's a character who had a short run in one of these anthology type books.
Right. And tipping off a future guest star of the book that Scott mentions, "I first read this story arc that we're going to be following, this Marvel 2-in-1 story arc, because of its connection to Spider-Woman when I was trying to read her entire series. Like, that was my through line." So, yeah, I basically knew everything that Scott just said, but I like the way he rephrased it, and he kind of put that all in order. And I think that's really good, really, really informative. So thank you very much for that comment.
And thanks for teaming up with me, Ryan. Tell people what else you're working on at the moment.
I am still working hard on Cheerscast, my podcast devoted to my favorite TV show, Cheers. We are in the back half of season 7, so should be wrapping up season 7 at the start of the summer. Another project that I haven't started yet, but it'll be a three-episode project for the long-forgotten Saturday Morning Fever podcast on the network. So look for that later on this year.
All right. A reminder that we do have a Patreon, so if you like this content, want more like it, please think about making a monthly or one-time donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards. Check it out at patreon.com/FWpodcasts. This month, we're proud to team up with our sponsor, Alan W. Wright, the Bold Outlaw. We do enjoy reading your thoughts. The best place for that is fireandwaterpodcast.com. We'll read your comments on this issue when Ryan is back with us. But next month, I'll be back here with Bass as we continue our coverage of DC Comics Presents with issue number 7. On that, see you next time for another amazing superhero team up, because after all, justice
is pewter. I mean, a team effort.